Hi, everyone. I know you've been hearing me talk about how much I enjoy BritBox. It's the streaming home of the best British TV, with exclusive mysteries, crime dramas, documentaries, and more. I especially enjoy mysteries like Agatha Christie's Poirot and Father Brown. I just enjoyed his story, The Thief, His Wife, and the Canoe. Great story. My daughter has always been a huge Cary Grant fan, and BritBox has a new original called Archie, which stars Jason Isaacs as Archie Leach, the man who became Cary Grant. This is the first time that his story has been told in collaboration with Grant's daughter Jennifer Grant and his ex-wife Diane Cannon. Story and cast all from BritBox, and it's top-notch entertainment, and only on BritBox. Sign up for BritBox today to stream Archie and other fan favorites from any device. I have a special limited-time offer for my U.S. and Canadian fans. Get 50% off your first month when you sign up for a monthly plan, but only if you go to BritBox.com and use my promo code 1001STORIES at checkout. That's 1001STORIES at checkout. Don't wait. Get 50% off your first month. Use promo code 1001STORIES at BritBox.com. You'll be glad you did.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome back, everyone, to part two of David Beer's story, Reign of Injustice, as the hunt for Michelle's killer produces all kinds of evidence, as well as definite suspects who admit they were with her late that night. But it's all looked at as being circumstantial. Meanwhile, the trials continue. And within 2 hours after a jury comes up with a guilty verdict, a new key witness steps forward, placing a man in his early 20s and driving a new Chevy truck with a crying Michelle at the end of her driveway in the early morning of September 12th. Which should have destroyed the prosecutor's theory that Cal killed her around midnight when she pulled into the garage. A motion is filed, and a new trial is set. Michelle would never reach the end of her driveway that morning, but that's not how the prosecutors played it. They wanted Cal Harris tried, convicted, and jailed, and did all they could to make that happen. And now our interview with Reign of Injustice author Dave Beers continues. Please pardon my harsh voice during this interview, as I was recovering from a cold on the day of the interview. Fortunately, Dave Beers does most of the talking. And now our story continues. Her lifestyle, was that allowed when it came to the trials in terms of how she was living, the kind of places she was hanging out? There were probably 12 to 15 different bars or taverns that she frequented where she was known within a 30 to 50 mile radius, I guess, of home. Did that come out in the trial? Was her character ever assaulted, or was she pretty much protected from all that?
Yeah, she's pretty much protected from that. Nobody wanted to say anything bad about someone who was believed to be dead.
Okay.
And so, you know, but there was a lot there, and that was another thing that really kind of disturbed me.
But that's probably what got her killed.
Yeah. They basically ignored her lifestyle and the people she was hanging out with. Just steered away from it completely. Even though, and there was also some early indications, we were never able to confirm this, but all of the evidence was kind of there, starting to take form that she was involved in drugs. She had the classic symptoms, you know, weight loss, smoking more, sniffling, not caring about her appearance. So those were all the classic signs. In fact, one of Cal's brothers said he recognized that because his own son had experienced something similar. So all the classic signs were there. And we knew that there was drug activity at Lefty's, and there was drug activity at a different car dealership that she was hanging around at when she was down in that area. And they didn't think those things were important to investigate. Like, who's she with? You know, what is she up to? You know, the other thing that I just recalled, during the investigation, one of the most routine things that you do is when you have a case like this is to pull the video footage from some of these places, whether it's a bar or a restaurant or a convenience store or whatever. They knew, the police knew some of these places that she frequented. But did they pull any of the video footage to see where she was, who she was with, what she was doing? No. Or if they did, they never disclosed it. That's irresponsible.
Can you think of any more important things that the NYSP investigation did not reveal that should have been revealed?
Yeah, one of the things, we discovered this later, after the first trial. One of the good things they did do was do polygraph exams of some of her boyfriends. Like Brian Early, for example, another man that she had a relationship with at Lefty's. He admitted to having a relationship with her for a brief period. They polygraphed him. They polygraphed one of Cal's coworkers, who they suspected may have had a relationship with her. There was another man at Lefty's who was a convicted sex offender from Arizona, or other violent sex offender. They polygraphed him. And they turned over all those results, and they all, the conclusion pages were that they were being truthful. But there was another man, a fifth man, who we didn't identify until later, who supposedly took a polygraph, but for some reason it didn't get included in the discovery material. It was only because of our due diligence that we were able to discover that there had been a polygraph of this other man. We never did find out what the conclusion was. They did finally claim that he was polygraphed and claimed he passed, but we never saw the results.
Describe the trials in brief, how each one went, and then when was the most information or the important witness revealed to your team?
Well, the first trial it was only about 2 weeks long. It went pretty much as planned. We thought we'd put on a great defense. You know, we called our own blood expert, and I think Joe Cawley did a nice job with cross-examining their expert. And we really, really thought that they just hadn't met their burden of proof. But unfortunately, the jury came back and convicted him. But Cal's co-counsel said later, he said Cal was not convicted for anything he had done, but rather for who he was.
Yep.
So it was kind of a character conviction. And so that was the thing that kind of jumped out at me as to how that trial went. And besides that, probably one of the most unfavorable components of the trial being held in Owego was the fact that it's a small town. Everybody knew Cal, and he had to deal with all the pretrial publicity before he went on trial. So
4 years, 4 years of it. Yeah.
Yeah, the cards were stacked against him right from the get go.
He was declared guilty of murder, too. So was he sentenced?
No, he was scheduled for sentencing, but he wasn't sentenced yet.
Okay, and then take us from there.
Almost immediately after the conviction, I'm going to say within 2 hours, Joe Cawley, his attorney, gets a call from a man named Kevin Tubbs. And he says that he has information that he just realized could be significant for the defense of Cal Harris. And he didn't know of its significance until he read a recent article in the paper covering the trial. So to make a long story short, we went and talked with Kevin, and he told a very credible story about where he was and what he was doing.
Could you relate that story in detail?
Yeah. So what he said was, you know, Kevin was a hay farmer at the time, and him and his family had been doing some haying on a road just down the road from the Harris driveway in that same general area. And they'd been haying that property for a long time, and they had a contract with the owner. And so on the morning of September 11th, he'd been working on that property, and he had loaded some hay onto a hay wagon, but he had another commitment that morning and didn't have time to haul it out of there. So he came back the next day on the 12th, and he gets up like 4:30 in the morning, and he drove his truck to the field. It's a long drive up into the field. It's real slow going. And he gets up in there. It's still dark. So he hooks up the hay wagon, which is already loaded, to his truck. He had a brand new Chevy truck. And then it's this real slow descent back down the hill with this real heavy load of hay. And then, so when he gets down to the bottom of the hill, he turns onto Forstrom Road, which is a little side road off Hagedorn. Then he comes out onto Hagedorn and goes north up toward the Harris driveway. And as he approaches the Harris driveway, and he knew the Harrises lived there. He didn't know them, but he knew of them. And he'd actually seen Michelle out there at the end of the driveway, you know, mowing the lawn, that type of thing, usually on a small riding mower. So he knew who she was or what she looked like. So he's driving up there, and he sees this pickup truck, which he described as either black or dark blue, angled out into the road, kind of blocking part of the road. And there was another vehicle in front of it, off to the side, light colored, he said. And as he gets closer, he's starting to get concerned about if he's going to have enough room to get by with this 9-foot wide hay wagon on a dirt road. And he didn't want to go into the ditch because that would be a disaster. So he's just creeping by. And as he gets right up almost on the bumper of this pickup truck, he sees a man standing there, young man in his 20s, dark hair, and he glares at him. Then he looks over and he sees a woman he believes is Michelle Harris, and it looks like she's crying or had been crying, but she doesn't gesture to him that she's in need of anything. So he glares at the man again and then goes on his way, and he just creeps by and gets by and then goes back to the farm and unloads his hay. So he revealed that story to us. So our first question was, you know, who is this guy? And what was he doing there? So if Kevin Tubbs' story was true, that punched a big hole in Cal's window of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking the difference between midnight and like 6 a.m. in the morning. That was pretty huge development.
Did he get a partial plate? Any numbers?
No. All he was positive of was that it was a Chevy. Because he said, I drive a Chevy, and I've been around Chevys all my life. So he knew it was a Chevy truck and a new one. And he described the guy pretty well. And he said, you get a picture of him, I'll know if it was him or not, because we glared at each other. In fact, he told me later, he says, I was almost hoping he's going to say something because I would have beat the snot out of him.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because Kevin was a big bruiser, football player. He was huge. Nice guy, though. I like Kevin. But anyway, so he relates this information to us. So we decide that rather than tell the police about it, we want to do our own investigation first, just to kind of corroborate, you know, what he's told us. So that's what I set out to do. We corroborated the haying property and where he'd been the day before, and then after he had dropped the hay off that morning on the 12th, he'd gone to his parents' house for breakfast. So we talked to them. They confirmed it all. They even remember him telling them about his encounter on Hagedorn Hill. So things are starting to come together pretty well. So based on that information, Joe Cawley put together a motion, what they call a 330 motion, which outlines evidence that's found after the fact that wasn't available at the time, and was requesting that there be a hearing. Well, of course, the police found out about it, and they went on the defense, you know, and tried to discredit Kevin Tubbs the best they could. But in the end, the judge agreed to hold the hearing, and Kevin Tubbs and his family testified, went in great, and the DA tried to discredit him best he could, but didn't work. So in the end, the judge, Judge Smith at the time, found that the Tubbs family was credible, and as a result, he threw out Cal's conviction.
Well,
So this was the same day that he was supposed to come in to be sentenced on the, on the eviction.
Man, talk about last minute save, Hail Mary.
So that was kind of a shocker for the news media. So Cal gets released from prison, and he's granted a second trial.
We'll return with Reign of Injustice Part 2 right after these sponsor messages. Hi, everyone. I know you've been hearing me talk about how much I enjoy BritBox. It's the streaming home of the best British TV, with exclusive mysteries, crime dramas, documentaries, and more. I especially enjoy mysteries like Agatha Christie's Poirot and Father Brown. I just enjoyed his story, The Thief, His Wife, and the Canoe. Great story. My daughter has always been a huge Cary Grant fan, and BritBox has a new original called Archie, which stars Jason Isaacs as Archie Leach, the man who became Cary Grant. This is the first time that his story has been told in collaboration with Grant's daughter Jennifer Grant and his ex-wife Diane Cannon. Story and cast all from BritBox, and it's top-notch entertainment, and only on BritBox. Sign up for BritBox today to stream Archie and other fan favorites from any device. I have a special limited-time offer for my U.S. and Canadian fans. Get 50% off your first month when you sign up for a monthly plan, but only if you go to BritBox.com and use my promo code 1001STORIES at checkout. That's 1001STORIES at checkout. Don't wait. Get 50% off your first month. Use promo code 1001STORIES at BritBox.com. You'll be glad you did.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
And now, back to our story. What happened at the second trial?
Kevin Tubbs was a gentle giant, but he was also a hothead.
Yeah.
So
they went after his personality.
Yeah, they really attacked him, and he wasn't taking any crap from the DA, and then he just kind of lost it, got angry, and that didn't go over well with the jury.
Exactly what the DA wanted him to do.
Yeah, they wanted to get under his skin, and they did that very successfully. And so as a result...
One would think that the New York State Police and the DA, having seen this man step up and give his version of what went on, and it's been corroborated in any number of ways, you would think that there'd be just a hint in their minds that maybe it's time to see some true justice.
You would think. I mean, that was my whole point.
But no, not at all. They're trying to save their reputation. They had a theory, by God, and they're going to stick with it if they have to see this guy go to the chair.
Yeah, I mean, because they had, I was hoping, having been a former police investigator, that they would take that information and investigate not only Kevin Tubbs. I understand their reason for investigating him. But once you're done with that, you got to investigate what he saw.
Yeah.
You know, and try to find out who this person is.
And did they?
Why he's there? But they never do.
Yeah, and there again, your injustice. There's your reign of injustice right there.
So it became a matter of salvaging their case against Cal.
So what happened? What was the outcome of trial two?
He was convicted, and this time he was sentenced to 25 years to life.
Yeah. Even with Tubbs saying that, hey, there's the last person likely that saw her alive, he saw him, and he can identify him. Even with that, the jury turned against him.
Well, and on top of that, just to add to the argument, he was retried in that same little town again, with everybody knowing that he'd already been convicted.
Didn't they ask for a different venue?
They did, but it was denied. So
he's convicted.
Yeah.
And what happens then?
Well, he goes to prison for he was committed to the Auburn Correctional Facility up in Auburn, New York. And then he remained there for the next 3.5 years.
And what happened with the children?
They were cared for by his aunt, who was his dad's sister. So they basically raised the kids.
Same property, or was that, or did they sell the property? Did they sell the property, and did he lose the dealership?
His general manager took over the dealership.
Okay.
But no, they kept the house for the time being. I don't know if they continued to live there or if the kids went and lived with their aunt. But she was great with them, very strong supporter of Cal, and she since passed away, unfortunately. But she would take them up to see Cal every weekend at the jail. So he stayed in played an active role in their in raising them. So.
Did you continue in the employment of him as a defense attorney during those years?
Once he was convicted and sentenced, my role became a lot less. I would consult with his attorney who was writing the appeal.
What happened with the guys from Texas? What was that story? One of them may well have been the killer. What was that whole story?
We identified these guys before the second trial, but it was all circumstantial stuff, and we weren't allowed to address it to very much extent during the trial.
But you had pictures. I was wondering if Tubbs ever got a look at their pictures.
Yeah. In fact, that was one of the first things that we did. Once we identified these guys, and it was kind of interesting how we did that, not long after Kevin Tubbs came forward, another man called, and he claimed to have information that could be helpful as well. So we get a hold of this guy. His name was Stephen Green. He lived down in Pennsylvania, just below Waverly, where this happened, where Michelle worked. He said he was surprised that Cal got convicted because he had heard some rumors around this steel plant where he used to work that two or more employees of the steel plant had been with Michelle on the night she disappeared. He said it was pretty common knowledge around the steel plant. He couldn't remember their names at the time, but he says if I hear them, I'll recognize who they are. So I went back to the drawing board, and I remembered after hearing that way back during the when we first started getting discovery material, I came across the lead that was assigned to an investigator to interview steel workers. And you know, I didn't put much emphasis on the lead at the time because there wasn't much there. But I remembered reading it, so I pulled it back out, and I'm looking at it, and it identifies this Stacy Stewart and this Chris Thomason as having been interviewed. Well, they interviewed Stacy Stewart. They didn't interview Chris. Well, they did, but they didn't tell us till later. But anyway, so I'm looking through the file, and there's no pictures, but there was a description of him because he had a prior DWI, so I got a physical description of him, but they'd also run a motor vehicle record on him, and in the motor vehicle record it showed that he owned a 2000 black Chevy pickup truck. And so that kind of rang a bell with me right away, so I contacted a private investigator in Texas. But she got back to me like the next day, and in Texas, she was able to get their driver's license photographs. So she sent them to me. And, you know, Stacy Stewart in particular, you know, jumped right out at me because he owned the truck and he fit the description that Kevin Tubbs provided. So I hung out to those photos, and I had a friend of a colleague of mine help me with the investigation. We started talking with coworkers of these guys at the steel plant. The steel plant itself wasn't real helpful. They were being very protective. You know how human resources is sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to arrange to interview some of these people at home rather than at work, which we did. And they all confirmed the identity and recognized the photographs. And so I called Steve Green back and told him the names. He says, yep, there's the ones. And he said the other thing, he says, not long after Michelle went missing, these guys packed it in and moved back to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay, that's interesting. So I started to, you know, see these red flags on Stacy Stewart. So I started to look at him a little more. And one of the things I learned was, in the address he listed in the report, the police report, I decided to check into that a little bit. So I went to the clerk's office and pulled the real property records on the his house to find out that he had abandoned it in February of 2002, he had just closed on the property 3 weeks before Michelle disappeared, and his first payment was due on the 15th of September.
Huh.
Never made the first payment.
Huh.
And never made any payments. He just abandoned the property, and then he finally he stayed there for a while, but then foreclosure notices started going out. I'd got copies of those, and so finally he must have seen the writing on the wall, and he quit work along with his other friend Chris, and they moved back to Texas. But another side story there. On their way back to Texas, they burglarized one of their co-workers' homes, one of the co-workers that worked at the steel plant. Now, they knew where the home was because they'd been invited to go there for Thanksgiving. So they stop there, they break in, and they steal some cash and some jewelry. And then we later found out that in addition to the cash and jewelry, he'd also stolen a folder with his name on it, because this girl, who was the wife of their coworker, was had kind of taken him under her wing because he was having trouble with his finances and she was trying to help him. So she kept a folder in her house with his name on it, utility bill, Time Warner bill, and his car payment, that type of thing. So in addition to the cash and jewelry, that folder was missing also. Their neighbor, who witnessed it happening, described Stacy Stewart and Chris Thomason in the truck that had a redneck sticker on the back, which matched his truck exactly. So anyway, but the bizarre part about it was about 2 weeks after this happened, this girl who was burglarized and had these things taken, she's telling everybody she knows that these guys burglarized her house and how upset she was that this jewelry was taken, because one of the pieces of jewelry had been given to her by her brother, and that was the only thing he'd ever given to her in her life, so it meant a lot to her. So word spread of this happening, and she goes into work one day shortly thereafter, and her boss hands her an envelope, and it's addressed to the bar where she worked in her name, but in care of this bar, and she opens it up, and it's the jewelry, and it has a Texas postmark on it. So, obviously, our case against Stacy Stewart starts to, a lot of red flags jumping up here.
I presume that the New York State Police at that time had no interest in more investigations.
No, their original report indicated that they had interviewed him. And here's where, in reading that report initially back when it first happened, I never picked up on it. But when I was investigating it now, after learning this from Kevin Tubbs, I'm reading through the lead, and right at the bottom paragraph, Stacy Stewart scheduled for a polygraph October 8th. So he was the one that they'd never disclosed.
Yeah. Okay.
We in talking to people that knew Stacy and his coworkers and friends, a girlfriend he had, she provided some real helpful information, and so we were under the impression that at some point in time Stacy had poured a concrete floor in his garage where Chris stored their ATVs, because he lit a little house, a little cabin on 4 acres of land. It was in a remote area, had a pond out front, but a lot of space out back where he could go four-wheeling. So we were suspicious about this concrete floor, and we didn't know if it had been poured before or after Michelle disappeared, but all indications were it was done after she disappeared. So we started looking at concrete dealers and to see if we could find out, you know, when it was poured. But by that time, you know, like 6 years had passed, and some of these places didn't keep very good records. So bottom line was we were never able to verify when it was poured or by whom. But despite that, we thought about digging it up. But before doing that, I suggested that we do a ground penetrating radar scan. So we found a guy that did that, hired him. He came down, you know, my colleague and I went and emptied out the garage with the new owner's permission and got it all ready. And they came down and scanned it. And pretty interesting technology. But anyway, you know, so it was so good that, you know, you could see the rebar in the concrete, you know. But in a couple of the images, there was actually a mass probably about 30 inches down that we couldn't identify what it was, but it was in contrast to the matter underneath the concrete, and we didn't know what it was, but we were very suspicious. So we decided to tear it up. So we did, and we did it ourselves. We my colleague had some experience with heavy equipment, so we tore it all up and then dug down, but we didn't find anything. And the mass that we'd seen in the images turned out to be a large deposit of clay.
Mm-hmm.
So we were disappointed, and we searched. We dug up an old well. We looked underneath an old outhouse. You know, we pretty much could think, well, we never found her. So, you know, and I had another colleague who was a certified diver. He dove the pond, found nothing there other than twigs and rocks. So. But the police never went there. They weren't interested in him. And then actually there came a time when I felt, I talked to Joe Colley about it. And I said, you know, I used to work with these guys. I'd like to think that if I share with them what I know, you know, maybe they'll take the lead on this. But I went there and laid it all out on the table, and they still did nothing.
There was a part of the story where a piece of clothing was found.
When we were interviewing people that knew Chris and Stacy, there was two or three, I believe, that told us that Chris in particular had made a comment about burning bloody clothes up at Stacy's house, burning the evidence up at Stacy's place in a burn pit. Yeah, so we heard that from two or three different people and who had contact with Chris on different occasions, and they heard the same thing.
So he had a pretty big mouth. Did some of those people who heard him talk begin to put facts together?
Yeah. Well, the one person that told us that was actually a girlfriend he had while he was up here, and she said that, you know, that really concerned her, but she was afraid to inquire further.
Yeah.
With him, but when we talked to her, she said, you know, I wish I had, because maybe I would have learned something more. But she said, I remember that very distinctly, she said, of him saying that. So when the third trial came along, Cal had gotten a different attorney, a new attorney down in Long Island. Bruce Sparquette was his name. And he had his own team of investigators that he was using in addition to myself. So we got together and decided that maybe we should dig up this burn pit. A lot of time had gone by, but... The new owner, we checked with him. He said he hadn't burned anything there other than, you know, branches and stuff like scraps of wood. So we decided to go ahead and do that. It was, but it was like January, but there hadn't been a deep frost yet. So we got a hold of this archaeological dig place at a college, and a professor of archaeology there, and he had a team that had done some digging before, and they were looking for some more experience. So they agreed to do it. They came up and they dug it up. I was impressed watching them do it. It was the first time I was able to sit back as an observer and watch them do the work. So they dug down layer by layer by layer. And in the bottom most layer, they found several articles that circumstantially were linked to Michelle. They found two scraps of clothing, real small. One was beige colored that would have matched the khaki shorts she was wearing. And another one was navy colored, which was the color of the top she was wearing. And they also found a partial bra strap, like a sports bra strap, which was also navy colored, still had the clasp on it. You know, Cal told me that Michelle always wore sports bras, and she usually wanted them to match the clothing she was wearing. And they also found a 6-inch blade of a knife, an ornate button, a house key, and a dime, which predated her disappearance. So all of those things kind of collectively, we believed, you know, corroborated the fact that there had been some burning of clothing, at least, in that burn pit. So we collected and preserved all those evidence, all those items. But due to the elements and the amount of time exposed to heat and all that, there was no DNA. We didn't really expect to find any, but we did have them examined. So when the trial came along, we tried to introduce those items, but you know, the judge said there wasn't enough circumstantial evidence without Michelle's DNA to allow them into evidence. So that was another blow for the defense. In addition, we tracked down Stacy Stewart's truck. After he moved back to Texas, it was repossessed and it was resold to another guy. And we tracked him down, lived way down in the bayou, Louisiana. Jeremiah, I think was his name. And initially, we were going to try to buy the truck to have it examined forensically.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't want to sell it. So we went to Plan B and offered him a rental fee to borrow it long enough to get it examined. So which we did. We took it to a garage, and we had two forensic investigators look it over. Interestingly, behind the door panel on the passenger side and on the rear seat area, there was evidence of blood staining.
Hmm.
It had degraded substantially over the years, and they were able to develop a partial profile, but it wasn't enough to include Michelle or exclude her. But interestingly, during that same exam, they found a silver studded earring, a diamond studded earring, in the seatbelt retractor on the passenger side, just kind of nestled down in there. And you could tell by looking at it that it was pitted. It'd been there a long time. And the owner said, Ain't no woman I know ever had no diamond ring, you know. So, mm-hmm. so we had that examined too, and they did find some DNA. Again, it was degraded, but they couldn't match it to Michelle, but they couldn't exclude her either.
Yeah.
So.
And is that as close as it ever got?
That's as close as it ever got. So, you know, not having law enforcement authority. Yeah, we were kind of limited, but we did go to Texas a couple of times and then talked to Stacy Stewart. You know, of course he lied every time we talked to him. So did Chris. But then when Cal got a new attorney, Bruce, he went down there with one of his investigators, and Stewart agreed to talk to him again, and so they confront him about the bloody clothes burning in his burn pit, and he. And he offers this rather bizarre explanation that Chris and his girlfriend came over there that night, and their clothes were bloody, and they wanted him to burn the clothes and give them some clothes to wear. And then he goes on to say, "I thought maybe they'd gutted a deer."
Yeah.
And nobody was buying that, you know. But that was his explanation. And we found out during that same interview that the police had finally gone and interviewed him, and he told them the same thing. But they do nothing with it.
Did his story and Tomlinson's story match up? Were they interviewed separately?
No, they were pointing the finger at each other.
No.
Yeah. You know, none of them would say what happened, but Stacy was claiming that it was Chris who was having a relationship with Michelle, and Chris said, "No way," you know. He said, "I had my own girlfriend up there," and so we were focusing primarily on Stacy, but I think they were both involved.
So what brought about the third trial, and what happened there?
Well, Cal's second conviction, when he filed his appeal, it was denied, but there was a five panel judges that made that decision. But one of the five wrote a dissenting opinion, a very lengthy dissenting opinion, agreeing with nearly everything the defense argued. So, as a result, with his permission, with that judge's permission, Cal's case was allowed to be heard by the upper court, the Supreme Court.
Of New York.
So mm-hmm. when his case went to the upper court, they unanimously overturned his conviction and he was released again. So that was after the second trial. So now, in addition to that, they also highly recommended a change of venue.
Mm-hmm.
So Cal got his change of venue, and the third trial was held about 120 miles away in another remote county, but in upstate New York near Albany. That's where his third trial was. The third trial was kind of a disaster. The judge kind of lost control of the trial, and it dragged on for 12 weeks.
Mm.
And then the jury, once they finally got the case, they deliberated for like 10 or 12 more days.
Wow.
Coming back at least twice, claiming they couldn't reach a verdict. And the judge would send them back and they'd have to try again. And finally they said, you know, we're hopelessly deadlocked. But the interesting thing about that, I don't think I put this in the book, but because it was getting too lengthy. But anyway, we found out that the jury in the third trial was split right down the middle. And they're not only split down the middle, but they were split by gender.
Huh.
The women wanted to convict and yep. The men to acquit.
Pretty much like the early opinions around Binghamton.
So for whatever it's worth, but as a result of that, we thought, we were hoping that they wouldn't try to retry him again, but they did. And Cal had long discussions with his attorney about how to proceed. And based on everything we knew, or that they knew about what had happened up to that point, it seemed as though Cal had fared much better with the courts than with juries.
Mm-hmm.
So he opted for a bench trial for his fourth trial. And as it turned out, it was a good decision. Yeah, Judge Mott was his name, and he was excellent, much better than the third. He kept control of everything, and in the end, he found him not guilty.
Well, now it's time for him to go try and go back and rebuild his life.
Yeah, he's still trying to do that. You know, there's a lawsuit pending against the county and the state for a number of things. I don't know what the status of that is, but those civil things can take quite a while.
Summarize your story, theory, as to what really happened for our listeners.
Well, it is just a theory, but based on my assessment of everything that I knew, based on interviews that I did or the police did, you know, collectively, I think that when Michelle left her boyfriend's house that night, she'd made other plans. She went downtown, back to Waverly, and met up with Stacy Stewart and Chris Thomason, who were frequent flyers at Lefty's. And, you know, they'd been hitting on her all along. And so they hooked up and started drinking, and the hormones start to kick in. And I think she, for whatever reason, maybe thought there was safety in numbers, because there was a third person there too that was involved by the name of Wright Childers. I think he was there that night too. And so they ended up going back out to Stacy's place. She followed him out there, what have you. And when they got there, you know, the drinking continued, and they ended up sexually assaulting her. And then Chris leaves, and Wright leaves, and Michelle tries to leave, but Stacy follows her. And she drives all the way to the end of her driveway, and he's still on her tail. So she said, I better stop and put an end to this. But when she does, he confronts her and wants her to come back to his place. She keeps telling him that she just let me go. I'm not going to say anything. But you know, he wasn't convinced. I think that he thought he'd be in big trouble if he let her go. And then along comes Kevin Tubbs, and he sees the aftermath of this argument. And after he leaves, he abducts her and takes her back to her place. And whether it was back at his place or along the way, she tried to resist, and he ends up killing her. So I think that's what happened. Don't know for sure, but in my opinion, everything kind of pointed to that type of scenario.
Thank you for sharing this story and this book. And we all wish justice could be served. And we're sorry for the injustice that seemed to be served. Are you left with even a 1% idea that it's possible that Cal Harris still could have done it? Or are you 100% on the other side?
No, I'm convinced he had nothing to do with it. I understand the strong argument as him being a suspect. That's kind of an automatic. But when you look at it from an evidence perspective, I don't think he had anything to do with it. You know, maybe one of these guys will say something at some point, or maybe she'll appear somewhere. I don't know. I'm not real optimistic that anything more will happen, but they're not going to pursue Stacy Stewart. They've already gone after Cal, and you know, if Stewart ever got arrested, his biggest argument would be, hey, he did it, you know. He's already been convicted twice, you know, and so I think he'll just walk free.
Were you involved in any other well-known cases in your professional work after that?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, John, I just published a second book. Almost as tragic as this one, here in the city of Binghamton. Yeah, I titled it Immunity for Murder. Because the really sad story, young woman, 23 years old at the time, four small children, single mom. She gets convicted of killing her two-year-old son, and she gets sentenced 25 years to life in prison. And her other three kids get taken away in foster care. 5.5 years. And the appellate court responds and throws out her conviction.
Wow.
Entirely. Saying that the evidence, the verdict was against the weight of the evidence. And then they went on to explain why. So she was set free, and she struggled to get her kids back, but she did. The real killer, her boyfriend, who was given immunity to testify against her, walked away.
David Beers, thank you very much for the Cal Harris story, Reign of Injustice. Thank you for all the work you did on behalf of the defendant. And this is one heck of a story. Readers, look for Reign of Injustice. It's out there at Amazon and everywhere else that good books are sold. David, give our listeners a few reasons why they should go out and look for this book.
Well, this book is interesting in many aspects. Cal was a wealthy businessman. He had a beautiful wife, four small children, but there was a divorce pending. Despite extensive searches, there was no body, no murder weapon, and only the scant evidence would only suggest that there was no evidence to suggest it was an assault or a murder. And Michelle was living an at-risk lifestyle. Even without any evidence, 4 years later, Cal was still arrested. There were several bizarre twists and turns along the way. So bizarre, at times, if I had written it as fiction, nobody would probably believe it. Nah, that never happened. But what makes it interesting is the fact that it did happen. And along the way, new evidence and other suspects were ignored. New defense witnesses were turned into villains. And the book also addresses the very issues plaguing our criminal justice system today that result in far too many wrongful convictions. the specific causes are multiple and often difficult to identify, but this book identifies several, including but not limited to conflict of interest, confirmation bias, malicious prosecution, failure to investigate, fabrication of evidence, suppression of evidence, lack of accountability, and supervisory oversight. I've often been asked by those who've read the book, how much did all this cost? The truth is, Cal's the only one that knows that. However, I would say a conservative estimate would be well over $1 million. That being said, in a similar situation, the average person would never be able to afford all that that was necessary to defend themselves. Inasmuch, without his financial resources, Cal would likely still be in prison.
Well said.
Yeah, I get asked that a lot. You know, how much did this cost? You know, what do you think? You think Cal still be in prison if he couldn't afford this? Well, probably.
Yeah. Thank you so much. It was nice meeting you.
Nice.
And I'll look forward to our next talk and receiving your book.
All right. It'll be on its way soon.
Bye-bye.
Thanks again.
Thanks for joining us for Reign of Injustice, The Cal Harris Story by David Beers. I highly recommend this book, and this interview should serve as a primer for you. There are a number of notable moments in the book that you'll find remarkable, one being the signal that Beers saw lead state police investigator Susan Mulvey flash to her father, whom Cal Harris had fired, in the courtroom when the jury delivered the guilty verdict to Harris. There are many more instances described that make you wonder how the state police operate and how many people are wrongly accused and tried every year. When Tubbs stepped forward with what was proven to be an honest story, that should have blown up the prosecutor's theory that Michelle had driven home to her garage around midnight and that Cal killed her there and then. Yet they stuck to their theory and succeeded in rattling Tubbs and turning the jury against him. And why wasn't the second trial held in another county when all the Oswego public opinion had been turned against Cal? So many questions. I hope you enjoyed the story, and I hope it leaves you with some questions about justice in America. If you did, send us a nice review, especially you Apple listeners, and share this episode with your friends. We'll be back next week Sunday night with a brand new episode here at 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries Podcast. This is your host, John Hagedorn. Stay safe, everyone, and we'll be back soon.
Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.